You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell, and this is The Life Aquatic. My guest today is John Herlig, an entrepreneur and former restaurateur who spent the past few years restoring a 30-foot sailboat. Many of you will be familiar with his very popular blog, avedelmar.com. For those of you who are not, John now lives on that boat and has recently set sail on a voyage of discovery. John Herlig, welcome to Boat Radio. Tell us a little bit about your sailing history. Did you sail as a kid?
I am an adult novice. I'm 51 and in my third or so year of sailing. Through my 40s, I had a couple with whom I was close friends who had boats. And I spent time with them on their boat. They had a downeaster that was very beautiful that we spent some time on. They sold that and bought an island packet. And I sailed with them some in Florida and in the Bahamas. But I am very much a later in life sailing novice, but a lifelong lover of the sailing culture and just the grace of moving under wind power alone.
What is it you do for a job, John? You work in Washington, D.C., is that right?
I don't work. I'm a veteran of the restaurant industry and things related. I spent many years roasting coffee. I was self-employed in the coffee business, roasted coffee and owned coffee shops. I owned a bakery. I've owned a New Mexican restaurant. So I was just sort of a career entrepreneur, but I was always driven by the challenge, never for the money. And my bank account would reflect that. So I would do things, and I was always excited by starting new ventures. I would get them up and going, and once they were running like clockwork, they were boring to me, and I would sell them and move on to the next. So that's what I did. I refer to myself as the voluntarily impoverished on the boat. I live on a small rental income that comes in from a house that I own up in Virginia.
So, Ave Del Mar, is this your first boat, or have you owned other vessels?
I have not owned other vessels. I found Ave Del Mar is the first boat I have ever owned. I found her. She was on the Hard in Reedville, Virginia. I had gone there to look at a boat that had been offered to me free, which shockingly would have been worth even less than I might have paid for it. It was just rotten and no good. And I wandered around the boatyard just looking at the boats, and there stood Ave up on her jack stands with an almost comically rusty for sale sign wired to the stern rail, kind of swinging back and forth in the wind as if it was a prop from a spaghetti western. And it was faded, and I copied the phone number off and called and spoke to the owner. Marge and Jamie Bryson, who live in Colorado now, were her then owners. And I was on the phone with them for about an hour and ended up climbing on the boat and looking around and falling in love. And that's what started it all for me.
And Reedville, that's on the Chesapeake Bay, right?
It is, just off the Chesapeake Bay. Indeed, a little fishing community. Formerly, there's a lot of really big, beautiful houses in Reedville that would suggest that perhaps back in the day there was a lot of money going through there. They've got the Menhaden fish plant, which might be their claim to fame at the moment, but they are just off the Chesapeake Bay and an international port, which is how Ave ended up there, easily accessible by water and not so much by land. It's quite a drive to get there.
So what condition was she in when you found her?
You know, that really is a multi-layered question. I'll tell you that as I stood on the ground looking at my now beloved Ave, she looked sad. She looked sun-bleached and worn out, and had rotting tarps covering things up on the decks. The paint was faded, and the wood was covered with a sort of chipping off brown paint. And yet at the same time, when I walked through the companionway and came below, despite the fact that she'd been sitting on the Hard for several years at that point, you could kind of just immediately feel the history of the boat when she came down below. So the bones were good. She didn't have any structural issues. She was solid. She's not cored, solid fiberglass, built in 1967, old school boat building technique. And yet at the same time, her electronics were either out of date or not functioning at all. The engine was, you know, coated with rust and hadn't run in several years. So she was an odd sort of mix of good bones, well-built, great potential, and a whole lot of logistical headaches in between where she was and where I needed to try to get her.
So was it love at first sight?
It was intrigue at first sight. It might have been love as soon as I stepped through that companionway. Ave de Mar has been around the world just shy of twice, once through the canals and once the southern route around the capes. And her history, which is certainly very distinct from my own lack of history, but her history is just evident. You can feel it down below. She's very, very blue water, has been set up to be blue water cruiser, and I think you can feel that when you walk below. And that's been more than me. The surveyor, when he stepped aboard, had the same comment when he stepped below. So I think I fell in love with the energy that I felt from Ave when I came below. I was intrigued before that, just at the full keel, the size of the boat, the fact that she was tiller steering. There were some things about her that were simple and sort of represented what I was looking for in a boat that spoke to me before I managed to fall in love with her.
Was it a fraught negotiation with the Brysons, or was it an easy deal?
Again, perhaps somewhere in between. I didn't have as much money as they were asking for the boat. Jamie Bryson, who was a journalist and a bush pilot in Alaska, has a past that's perhaps as varied as mine, wrote a book about their first circumnavigation called First Time Around. And I think their love for the boat was so deep that they were emotionally still very connected to her, but he had come down with Parkinson's. So they had their own battle going on of not wanting to let go of the boat, but needing to let go of the boat. I wanted the boat, but didn't have the money for the boat. And those interests collided a few times in the center. But as I told the Brysons, I thought I was perhaps the right person who was crazy enough and had the right vision for the boat, that I was the right guy for the boat. And I just felt like we had to work through it. So We found a way to take the boat. She wasn't listed with any broker. She was just sitting there with her Wild Wild West for sale sign. And they promised not to sell it to anyone else if I could save up the money in the course of a month or two. And that's what we did.
And so I've got to ask you at this point, and it's a delicate question, but I'll ask it anyway. And feel free to not answer if you prefer. But how much did you pay?
I paid $21,500 for the boat.
Okay. Well,
not a great deal of money, but again, having always been driven more by my passion than by my pocketbook, I did not have $21,500 sitting in the bank. There was also a very legitimate issue as to whether or not she was worth $21,500. Certainly to the Brysons, she was worth that and a lot more. According to the surveyor, she might have been worth a good deal less. But I thought there were, for me, two important things that came into play on the price, one of which was improvements made to the boat that really don't have dollar value. Things, how she's been re-rigged. These boats were all built as sloops, but suffered from a pretty bad weather helm. So most Rawson 30s have been re-rigged as cutters, which Ave would be as well. Fiberglass work that's been done in the cockpit to limit the volume of space in the cockpit, and just improvements left and right that gave her legitimacy that I didn't really feel had a dollar value. And the other thing really being, if you're living in Washington, D.C. in a $2,000 a month apartment, if you spend 3 months looking for a similar boat that costs $5,000 less, are you ahead or are you behind if you've been paying rent in the interim? So I was fine with the 21.5, and we went forward from there.
So you were living in D.C. What did you do with Ave Del Mar at this point? Did you move her?
Yeah, the grand plan, And boy, isn't that an opening in the world of sailing. The grand plan was to spend 2 weeks on the boat after closing in Reedville, getting her ship shape and ready to go, and then motor sailing her north from Reedville up to Annapolis, where I had arranged for a slip at a marina. And Annapolis, Maryland, self-proclaimed sailing capital of America, is an easy half-hour or so drive from Washington, D.C., where I was working. So my plan was to sail her up to Annapolis, live aboard, and keep working in Washington, D.C. That sort of happened, although not exactly the way it had been planned. I was having rigging issues, I was having engine issues, none of which is really surprising after the time she'd spent just sitting idle. And I got to a point where I realized that I just wasn't comfortable taking the boat out into the Chesapeake. And so I made the decision to just have her trucked up to Annapolis. So I paid to have her shipped, you know, took the mast down, built a cradle, tied it off, and had the boat shipped up to Annapolis, where I got to live aboard in the marina and at a more realistic pace complete the repairs that would make her sail worthy.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. I'm talking to John Herlig, who is aboard his 1967 Rawson Cutter. We'll take a short break now. When we come back, we'll find out some of the fascinating history of Ave Del Mar.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
This is Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. I'm talking to John Herlig, who has painstakingly restored a 1967 Rawson Cutter, the Ave Del Mar. John, tell us about Ave. What kind of vessel is she? Who designed her? How is she rigged? You've given us hints of some of this so far, but give us the detail.
So Ave Del Mar is a Rawson, R-A-W-S-O-N. Ron Rawson was, from what I understand, one of the first U.S. builders of solid fiberglass fishing vessels up in the Pacific Northwest of America, up in the in Washington State. And sometime in the 1950s, Mr. Rawson decided that he wanted to make an entry-level family cruiser, a sailing boat. And the Rawson 30 is the boat that he built for that. It was designed by William Gardner. He built, off the top of my head, maybe 300 or so Rawson 30s, most sloops. He built some pilot houses, and a number of them were catch rigged, but most of them were just standard 30-foot sloops. Some were owner-finished, delivered with bare interiors, but he built them from sometime in the late 1950s up into the mid-1970s. I've certainly learned that on the East Coast of America, it's often not recognized, but the Rawson internet boards would suggest that there's still a lot of these boats up in Northern California, San Francisco Bay Area, and up all the way up through Alaska, which is where my boat hailed from prior to being mine. So she's a 30-foot cutter rigged, Ave in particular, well over-rigged. She was dismasted in Puerto Rico in a hurricane, and when they put a new mast on, really over-rigged it in a good way, because she has spent her life from the mid-70s on cruising the world. Solid full keel, draw about 5.5 feet, just wide enough to be comfortable at about 9 feet, nice and short on the mast, so at 46 feet I can sneak under some bridges that other people can't. And I would be her only third owner in all her years.
And have you updated her with all the modern technology, all the gadgets?
Within reason, yes. One of the daunting but important and obviously necessary tasks ahead of me when I got Ave was to update her electronics and just simply to rewire her. It is no exaggeration to say that when I bought the boat, to get any of the electronics to work often involved reaching a hand into the engine compartment, grabbing the wiring harness, and just shaking and hoping that whatever it was you wanted to work would sort of crackle to life and start doing its job. She's about 90-95% rewired from the simplest things like lights, which I've got all new light fixtures, all LEDs that I don't draw much, down to the more important electronics, VHF, SSB radio, communications, circuit panels, you know, voltage meters, all those things have been replaced and updated. So she certainly has my thumbprint on her now. She's mine, set up the way I'd like her to be set up. The electronics are current and good and up to date, and everything works. No more reaching in to shake the wiring harness to get things to crackle to life. In other regards, Ave is really dumbed down and simplified, and that's a part of her blue water nature. I don't heat water. I don't have pressurized water. I hand pump water. My sink in the galley does not drain through the hole. Actually, I use a bucket in the sink. The through holes were glassed over. As Nigel Calder wrote in the beginning of one of his through hole articles, he said, "Through holes sink ships. If you don't need one, don't put it in." So I never changed that. I use a composting toilet, so I don't have a holding tank. And in that regard, we're kind of bare bones. I don't use a lot of electricity. I can go pretty fair amount on the fuel that I can carry, and my goal is always to use the wind where I can. So she's been updated. There's still a lot of TLC in her future. I was out in the sunshine yesterday sanding mahogany cap rails, trying to get those revarnished. So, you know, those projects never, ever end. But the real things that make her a vessel that can safely carry you through a body of water have been updated to a point that I'm satisfied.
Do you have a refrigerator?
I do not. Funny thing, when I first, and I think it's true, whenever someone with starry-eyed love of boats first climbs onto a boat they might want to buy, you see so many things, and it's such a rush of emotion. You're trying not to simply stand there and just be in love with the boat. You're trying to look critically. And I had a conversation with Jamie Bryce and her former owner not long after that first day that I climbed aboard, and I said, you know, I understand she doesn't have refrigeration. I said, but surely she has an icebox somewhere, but I didn't see it. And he very tersely replied, no, she doesn't have an icebox. Iceboxes need ice. Ice is a pain in the butt. She doesn't have an icebox. And I'd really never put thought to this before, which is sort of funny because I've now lived in this environment for 3 years. And I said, well, without an icebox, what did you do? And he quite simply answered, John, I'll tell you, for all the years I lived on that boat, I never went to bed hungry. And that really kind of summed it up to me. And I said, there's a way to do this, and I just don't know how to do it yet. And that was something that really I liked. I like that I'm not constantly in search of ice. I like that I'm not constantly topping off my batteries to keep a compressor running. And I like my scotch neat anyway, so I don't miss ice too much.
She's a well-traveled boat, John. You told us a little bit about some of that earlier on. Twice around the world, almost. Had the Brysons owned her many years? Did you know all of that before you bought her? Did Jamie tell you all about this before you actually handed over the money?
Yes, absolutely. So I was fortunate enough that there was a copy of his book, First Time Around, on the boat that they let me borrow and take home with me after that first visit. I was so eager to read it and promised that if somehow I didn't buy the boat, that I would UPS the book back to them in their home in Colorado. Bryson's owned Ave since sometime in the early to mid-70s. I don't want to put the wrong year on it, but somewhere in that range. And owned her until, obviously, I bought her from them. So their history with the boat was extensive. They're the ones who logged all the miles. And that first circumnavigation for them was from Wrangell, Alaska, their home, Jamie and Marge Bryson and their 11-year-old son, Stuart, when they left. And that was a 5-year circumnavigation that took them through the Panama and Suez canals, through all the adventures that one might expect. And a lot of respect for them for admitting to how little they knew when they started and how steep the learning curve was, for finding a way to survive as a family of three on a very small boat that has only one stateroom, and going around the world and coming back that much richer for the experience with a then 16-year-old son who probably got more of an education from those 5 years than any school ever could have given him in the process.
How long did all the work take you?
That would imply that there is a...
There's an end to it.
beginning and an end, which there certainly isn't. So this would have been August of 2013 that I took possession of the boat. It was the summer of 2014 before I had her re-rigged and the mast re-stepped. So it was the summer of 2014 before I actually got to sail the vessel. But, of course, I had to teach myself how to rig, which everything was new to me. I certainly grew up, thanks to my father, with a great deal of just mechanical know-how and common sense and, you know, tools and fixing things was a part of my skill set, but not specific to boats. So I bought myself a length of wire rigging and some stay-lock fittings and sat in the boat and just practiced and practiced until I got what I thought was satisfactorily good at it, re-rigged the boat. That would have taken us into 2014, but I'd say another good year after that into last year before the electronics, the rigging, the sail, the constant things that just sort of pop up in your path were muted to the point that I thought she was more sailable than not. Certainly, I think I suffer from the same thing that many sailboat owners do, which is I sit here and I think I'm as good at any as just appreciating the beauty of the boat that I love and that I live in. But I certainly look around every day and see, ooh, I need to fix that. I need to and re-varnish that and fix this problem and fix that. So I think that is a bit like chasing the horizon. But it was a couple of years of process until she got to a point to where I'd say she could responsibly go out in the water. And of course, if I had a big bank account and nothing but spending my time and money on the boat, it would have been faster. But I was working a full-time job to get the paychecks to work on the boat, and that complicates the process.
Sure. And you did the overwhelming majority of the work yourself, it sounds like.
I did, yes, darn near everything myself, exceptions being things like when I first left Annapolis, November of last year, 2015, with my son heading to Florida. He was going to spend a month with me. And not 2-3 hours south of Annapolis on the Chesapeake Bay, the transmission was just making a horrible whining sound. So we shut the engine off, raised the sails, turned around, sailed back to our slip in Annapolis, and had someone come check out the transmission, which, lo and behold, needed rebuilding. So I will tell you, I can pull the transmission out of this boat in less than a half hour, which I'm proud of, but did I actually rebuild it? No. And that's sort of where I draw that line. But yeah, all the mechanical, the engine work, rigging, painting, all that stuff I've done myself.
I have to say that is really impressive. It's very impressive. I mean, a lot of people who own boats do a lot of the work themselves, partly because it's so expensive, partly because, you know, you often have to move the boat or put it on hard standing, and it's just an incredible faff. But nonetheless, it's an impressive thing to have restored a boat. How much do you think it cost you? Not your time, but just in terms of cash.
I am not exaggerating when I tell you I have not a clue. At no point in time did I think it was going to behoove me to stop and add that up. And I suppose that if I reach a point where I need to pass Ave along to a next owner, if I'm fortunate enough to be sitting here having this conversation with someone 30 years from now, when I'm no longer the right answer to Ave, then it might be pertinent to my story to stop and actually add it up. I can assure you I have every receipt. But the journey for me was not one that had to make fiscal sense. It had to make life sense. And knowing or not knowing what the dollar amount of those improvements has added up to has just never been of any interest to me. And I would think that I probably have close friends who love me dearly who think that beyond naive, verging on perhaps stupid. But it's my reality, and it's what works for me because it's a very experiential thing. I don't think there's a lot in sailing that really works from a logic standpoint outside of the logic of the physics that makes the boat go. But in a larger sense of purpose, I think if you're driven by logic, you're going to cry yourself to sleep many nights.
How did it feel when you... Let me start again because my neighbor's dog just started barking over the top of that very important question. I might just leave that in. How did it feel when you set sail for the first time?
It was a culmination of so much hard work. It was gratifying. This was on the South River in Edgewater, Maryland, which is basically right Annapolis. And I tipped the gas girl to help me in and out of my slip and motored off out into the river, unfurled the sail, went for a little bit, and I reached through the companionway and pulled the kill switch on the engine. And I just wanted to stand up and shout to everyone that I'd ever met along the path who had been giving me grief for not having sailed sooner or sailed more. My neighbors who were going out from the marina were wondering why I was still there feeding mast wires through the hawse pipe or whatever it was I might have been doing. It was so gratifying to see that she could actually do what I envisioned that she would be able to do again and to do it well, and that I carried that knowledge of everything, not everything, but within reason of what was making it come true. That when the engine started was because I'd been involved in it, and when the mast didn't collapse was because I had re-rigged it. So I felt a great sense of ownership of all of those processes that made it come together, and I knew there was still a long ways to go. But yeah, that was that. It's your kid's first steps, or whatever parallel you might want to draw, where it came together and in the way that I had visualized it, and was very, very gratifying, really beyond words.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. My guest is John Herlig, and we're talking about his restoration of Ave Del Mar, a 1967 Rawson cutter he found in a boatyard in Reedville, Virginia. It's time for a short break. When we come back, preparations for the voyage of a lifetime.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures. I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
This is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of GLOC Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, director of membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
You are listening to Boat Radio.
This is Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. I'm talking to John Herlig, who's in Florida in the United States and whose home waters are those of the magnificent Chesapeake Bay. So, John, you set sail, I think, in June last year. Is that right? Where have you been since then?
No, incorrect. I left the first time, actually, November of last year, Annapolis, to head south. That first trip was cut short by a transmission that had met the end of its days and had to be rebuilt. So I limped back to Annapolis and left again the middle of December. And my voyage since then has taken me down through the Chesapeake Bay and through the Intracoastal Waterway down the east coast of America, slightly off schedule, but on track as far as what I'd hoped to do. So my goal had very much been to come down the waterway to Florida so that the boat and I would always be close to resources as things might go wrong along the process. I felt like I was new enough at this and had enough to learn, and the boat was old enough and had enough to break that perhaps we both needed to make sure that we had resources available to us. So that's what we've done. And I guess in the sense of world cruising, just coming down the east coast of the United States and the Intracoastal Waterway isn't a great stretch of geography. But I'll tell you, again, experientially, it's huge because you're in all different weather windows, all different bodies of water, all different sailing and anchoring and docking dynamics. So it's been a world of experience in that short time and short distance that we've covered.
You know, I think the amazing thing, the thing that most surprises me personally about the Intracoastal Waterway is actually that so few people have heard of it. It's a 3,000-mile long inland waterway. It's possible to sail a boat inland within the United States from where does it begin? Norfolk, Virginia, all the way down south to Florida, then back up Florida and through the Gulf States, and as far as Texas. I've actually just read What's Up, Ditch, which is Chris DeCroce's fantastic book about traveling the Intracoastal Waterway. And I feel like I've got to do it now. I might have to, you know, join you, borrow your boat. But, I mean, anyway, what prompted you to take the Intracoastal Waterway rather than head out to sea and down the coast? I mean, why did you want to take that inland waterway? And how did you get on?
So what prompted me to do it, for me, there was absolutely no question. Because we're on the east coast of the United States, we've got that lovely Gulf Stream, that river of water that runs 2 or 3 knots from the south to the north, just off the east coast of the United States. So if from the mid-Atlantic or north one wishes to go south out in the Atlantic Ocean, you first have to make enough east to get outside of that Gulf Stream and then head south. And so for someone with my experience and with a boat that, as I said, I felt was probably going to, you know, hand me a few surprises along the path of things that I wasn't quite prepared for. Going outside for a trip of that magnitude just made absolutely no sense. The Intracoastal Waterway, which is certainly well known to people who live up off the Chesapeake and on the east coast of the United States, brought the comfort of being close enough to land together with, like I said, an entire spectrum of experience for what was in store for me along the path. So in Annapolis, the more northern end of the Chesapeake Bay, I was, a number of days south through the Chesapeake Bay. I had to hide from weather at one point. We had a small craft advisory and some 6 and 7 foot waves out in the Chesapeake Bay. The Chesapeake Bay can be really deceptively vicious for a body of water that is not as large as an ocean. And when it gets that angry, we hide. So I lost a few days to that, but made my way south, and down in Norfolk with the naval vessels and the tugboats and all the activity that hums around, I joined into the Intracoastal Waterway, made my way through the dismal swamp canal and started heading south.
Did you struggle with the huge, because there's an enormous, because it's tidal, there are enormous quantities of water rushing in and rushing out of the Intracoastal Waterway at, I imagine, quite considerable speed. And you've got all sorts of problems. You know, you've got there are bascule bridges that you've got to navigate, perhaps against a considerable, a very, very powerful current. How did you get on with all these tricky navigation problems and maneuvering problems of maneuverability and space and all that sort of thing?
Sure. And your question is, I have to say, absolutely dead on. And I want to make sure I go out of my way to make it clear that I am not the grizzled veteran with 30 trips up and down the Intracoastal Waterway. But at the same time, I think one only needs to have done it once to fully understand what it has to offer, which is precisely what you just touched on. And that runs such a range from anchoring issues, current, tide, bridges, all those things, and each of them is unique. So I've been doing this single-handed, which certainly also changes the dynamic. I'd had the benefit of doing the Intracoastal Waterway in Florida from St. Augustine down to West Palm with friends on their island pack at 380. Cara Mia, by the way, and my dear friends Chip and Tammy. So I wasn't completely naive to the experience, but you certainly have to learn your own way of getting through. So there's certainly rhythms that you establish being single-handed. It didn't take me long to learn how to take every single thing I might need for the day into the cockpit with me, because you can't hand the tiller over to someone else and run below to make lunch or take care of whatever it might be that needs taking care of. So I pretty quickly learned how to map out my day my way, and I think everyone does it differently. But I certainly, in a broad sense, would the evening before would plot out my next day, including four or five, sometimes even six different bailout anchorages where if the boat had problems or if weather turned or if I was just fatigued and couldn't really sail safely anymore, that I could just glance down at my chart and know where it was I was going to head, what the closest safe anchorage might be for me. And the other part of that is just along the path, you get those stories that people like me tell over beers and bars. I remember up in Titusville where I anchored in a just terrible anchorage out in the middle of a wide body of water with absolutely no protection and winds that were howling steady up around 30 or so all night long. I'm not sure I slept much. I was so eager to get underway the next morning and called to the railroad bridge, bascule, also two different spans that went across. And I called for my opening, and they said, sure. And it was just tide, current aplenty pushing me right through. And I called, and they said they were going to open. Then the bridge tender came back on and said, oh, by the way, just so you know, only half the bridge opens. And I was just sure that this was going to be my bridge where I had to explain to people how it was that I ran into a drawbridge that didn't open and why my mast was at the bottom of a body of water and how it was my boat came to be in shambles. But somehow you get through those, and for all the white knuckles and everything that comes along with it, more often than not, we get through. And when things go wrong, there's a community of people out there that are hopefully only a radio call away, ready to help you out.
You know, when you hear people describe their voyages up and down the Intracoastal Waterway, it very often comes across that the ICW is kind of a trial by ordeal that you have to go through if you want to be a proper sailor. But it must be fun as well, right?
It is. Absolutely spectacular. And I think for me, at least, many times both of those emotions occurred simultaneously. When half of my brain was in a near panic, trying to figure out how to write something that was going wrong, and the other half of my brain, perhaps perpetually the 14-year-old boy, was just sitting there going, oh my God, this is so cool. I can't believe we're doing this. And I think you have to have a little of both of those to get through it. You have to be analytical. You have to be safety-minded. You have to pay attention to details. It's not always going to go perfectly, and there's, I think, always got to be that voice in your head that can go, we made it through that, you know, and the sun's going to rise tomorrow, and we can start all over again. Isn't this awesome that we're out here and doing this and engaged and alive and doing something that's very real? I remember explaining exactly that to my son on the phone one day when I'd made through just a hideous day on the Chesapeake Bay, and it was windy and wavy and wind against current, and just one of those horrible days, and I was tired and fighting it and having such a great time. It is the sort of trial by fire. And, you know, I think you need enough of a base knowledge, or at least enough of a base respect for how quickly this can go wrong, that you put just an incredible amount of energy into trying to make it not go wrong. But that last X percent, you just kind of have to leave to Poseidon and talk about it later over cold beer in a bar.
So you can probably hear a moped in the background. I'm sitting in my garden in the very small city of Sóller in northern Mallorca in the beautiful Tramontana Mountains. It's paradise. So I'm in the mountains, but I'm looking out at the Mediterranean, and it's an amazing place. But the streets are so narrow that some of them,
amazing.
You know, you can touch either side. If you're 6 feet tall, you can reach and touch both sides, but it means the mopeds are loud. You know, the kids coming home.
I can't hear the mopeds. I lived in Switzerland for a year, and the sound of the moped would probably only make me smile. I used to actually drive milk from a dairy farm where I worked to the dairy on the back of a moped.
Oh, wow, that's another story altogether. We should talk about that another day.
It's got nothing to do with sailing.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. My guest is John Herlig, who is aboard his painstakingly restored Rawson 30 cutter. We'll take another short break. When we come back, I'll be asking John about his relationship with the ocean.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea. From boats of woven reed in Egypt, to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea, all that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. The Maritime History Program, with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
This is Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. I'm talking to John Herlig, whose blog, AveDelMar.com, is a terrific read. I highly recommend it. It details, among other things, his restoration of a 1967 Rawson 30 cutter, aboard which he now sits as he talks to us. And he's in Florida now, having restored the boat in Annapolis. John, according to your website, you require only one further item of equipment before you are ready to set sail around the world. Have you got hold of said, I think it was a satellite beacon, and are you on your way now? Is this a circumnavigation that you've started?
Okay, that's a complex question. I will say first that I confess that I'd forgotten all about that page of my website, although it's not incorrect. I still don't have an EPIRB. I think that I probably represent the view of a dramatic minority in that I am not particularly wound up about the EPIRB. That being, of course, the identification beacon that you trigger if you are in dire circumstance in the ocean. It triggers to a satellite, which alerts rescue authorities, et cetera, et cetera. I was having a discussion with this right here in West Palm with someone who was walking by the boat when I was at a dock, and they were asking about it. And I think, without sounding dire, I have every intention of living and every intention of doing everything I can to make sure that if things go wrong, I have the resources that will allow me to survive. I don't know if in the grand picture of things, I really feel that I need to be plucked out of the ocean by a helicopter in the middle of a hurricane if I've been either dumb or unfortunate enough to sail into it. I have a life raft. I have an incredible dose of caution on my side. I don't have the EPIRB and haven't yet figured out whether or not it's a must for me before I shove off from American shores.
Has it always been a dream of yours to circumnavigate the globe?
Oh, and that was the other part of your question, which I failed to answer. So I have a note on the profile page of my Instagram account that says quite simply, it's a life journey, not a sailing journey. And that's very true. I have had a lifelong love of the sailing culture, of sailing boats. I got that from my father, who much the same was on the outside looking in, but fondly tells the story still. He's 86 now, of buying a book, what was it, 10,000 Leagues Over the Sea in 1940 or so for 5 cents at a store down the street, and forever falling in love with the ocean and sailing. I am less interested in putting the notch in Ave Del Mar's belt of saying that she's completed another circumnavigation, and I'm much more interested in a journey that is, for me, rich with experience of getting outside of my comfort zone. As I tell people, I'd like to end up places where I have to go ashore and don't speak the language and find groceries and meet people. That's what works for me. That, to me, means that I would not be doing a sort of stereotypical, what we call snowbird routine. You're somewhere north of the Mid-Atlantic, eastern United States. In summer, in winter, you go to the Bahamas. You might well be next to the same people in the Bahamas that you are next to at your home, and you spend the winter there and then come back. And I think that's a great thing. It's not my thing. I'd like to see the world. I'd like to get out there and get to those little villages that no one in their right mind would go to via airplane and land travel, that are just readily accessible to me. For example, the southwest coast of Haiti in Hispaniola. I'd love to sail there. I've read a lot about it. May or may not happen, but I think it's a good example of the sort of thing that I'm looking to experience, and it's a little outside of the norm for a lot of people.
Let me rephrase the question a little, because I asked if you'd always dreamed of circumnavigating the globe. Have you worked out your route, and where are you headed next?
I have absolutely not worked out the route, because, of course, it's always subject to change, influence from weather, boat mishaps, et cetera, et cetera. I would say that I certainly have a good firm idea of how I'd like to start. And that's that journey that I'm already on, despite the fact that I'm in Florida and haven't yet left domestic shores. I'm on that path and on that journey. So for me, that involves doing what we call the thorny path, island hopping from the Bahamas all the way down to South America, which I've sort of lost my weather window to be able to do that because of hurricanes coming. Had considered changing that route and maybe going through the Bahamas and then hopping straight in a long shot down to Curacao or Bonaire, somewhere down towards South America. And am at this point thinking that I might just hide here through the summer, start up again in the fall when the hurricane's starting to dissipate. So you have to have a plan of sorts. And this is how I always explained it to the people that I worked with when they would ask me questions about it. It reminds me so much of expecting my first child, which has been many years ago now for me. I don't think you can expect a child and not have some sort of idea of how you think you're going to parent. You have to know if you're planning on feeding on demand, or are they going to cry themselves to sleep? Are you the structure parent or the giving in parent? And you have to have all those ideas. And then the kid comes along and lets you very, very shortly know that all of your ideas were fantasy at best, and you're going to adapt to the reality that you have. I see my sailing journey as pretty much exactly that. I'd like to go through the canals. I am years, perhaps decades away from being the sailor that would be required to go around Cape Horn, despite the fact that my boat has done it and I have video of that, I'm not. So I'd be looking at making my way to South America, spending some time there, Panama, Costa Rica, whatever makes me happy at the time, and hopefully getting Ave through the Panama Canal a second time and heading out towards the South Pacific. It's a sort of nebulous, suggestive plan at this point, and every step that I take, the near-term details come into more focus.
Are there any time constraints on your journey? You don't have to be somewhere in 2 years.
I have absolutely no time constraints at all. One of the first things that I remember at learning, which I think I read, a phrase that I love so much, which is perhaps the single most dangerous thing you can have aboard a sailboat, is a schedule. I adhere to that. It's why I think you have to leave. And the moment you untie that last dock line, you are on your journey. And if you feel that you're not on your journey until you are at point X, then I think you're really in danger of making some poor decisions along the path. So I've been on the journey, even if I sit in South Florida for 5-6 more months and then continue on. That, to me, is part of the journey. If you're reading the book, which doesn't exist yet, you know, when you read that that character stopped because weather, you know, the season was getting late and the weather was about to turn, it makes sense. It reads into the narrative, and, you know, a few pages later, the story picks up and continues. So I've got to worry about maybe weddings or kids coming at some point. My children are all in their 20s, but they're all certainly very supportive of what I'm doing, and I remind them all the time. I say, if you decide you're getting married or if you're going to have a kid, I'll have to see where I am and what the bank account looks like, and I will do my level best to get back. But I have no concrete time constraints at all. This is however long I want it to be.
John, what do you love most about living on a boat?
I can answer that very, very easily. I love not being thoroughly insulated from the nature around me. I love the fact that I've got protection from the elements. I can stay inside if it's raining, turn on the fan if it's hot, and bundle up if it's cold. But I don't live oblivious to what is happening in Mother Nature's world around me. I live, to whatever degree I can, in harmony with it. And that, to me, resonates very, very deeply. I've never enjoyed sitting inside where it's always 70 degrees, be it 10 degrees outside or 100. And I feel like I have a very real day ahead of me every day where I'm going to find my peace with the nature around me. I need to make sure I've got food and water, something to eat, and protection over my head, but I'm not faking my way through it. And that resonates with me more deeply than anything. And I find that the people I meet along the path are other people for whom that experience is the same. And so I tend to enjoy the company of those people along the path too.
How would you describe your relationship with the ocean?
You know, it's such a great question, and it's one that I'm not qualified to answer because I don't have, and I hope I'm not misanswering the question, but I haven't crossed oceans. I've spent time in substantial bodies of water on my boat at anchor. I'm not a marina hop. I don't go from dock to dock to dock. I live almost exclusively at anchor, and so I'm always at the mercy of the water around me. But I feel like that word ocean is a whole different thing, and that to me means days or weeks and weather patterns that I don't have the experience to accurately read yet, and sailing both through weather and through doldrums, whatever it may be, which is an experience that I don't yet have. So perhaps then accurately my answer to your question is I'm intrigued by the ocean. I'm confident that I will be okay, which doesn't mean that I'm not going to have my moments or perhaps days of terror along the path. But it's just one of those things that I feel like is a good part of my future, ocean crossing. And I think the ocean and I, despite some rocky moments, are going to get along okay. I think I'm wired in a way that that tranquility and that challenge is something that's going to work for me.
Well, I can only wish you the very best of luck. I hope you enjoy the journey ahead. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. John Herlig, AveDelMar.com. Thank you very much indeed for talking to Boat Radio.
You're very welcome, and thank you for the time. It was fascinating.